From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong says universities around the country should have seen the problem of sexual assault coming. Armstrong says if you understand the way college culture, college life works these days, you can kind of predict sexual assault really as a logical outcome. Today in the program, Armstrong is joining us as we begin a series of conversations about modern college life and the problem of sexual assault. Among the structures, she says, that play into all of this is the relationship between schools and the Greek system and the financial pressure to attract students with social experiences. Armstrong says there's an incentive built into this system to give students more of what they want than what they need. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's been a lot of discussion lately about how to deal with and prevent sexual harassment and sexual violence on and near college campuses around the country. The sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong doesn't believe the problem is some passive result of hormones and circumstance. She says this isn't about young people doing what comes naturally. She says sexual assault is usually a predictable outcome of the structures put in place by the grown-ups. She says in some cases they were allowed to happen by college administrators who benefit from the arrangements that are at the heart of the issue. So today in the program, we're going to talk about how the culture of college life contributes to the prevalence of sexual assault. Elizabeth Armstrong is with us, and we invite you to join the conversation as well. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here are some of the questions we're interested in. What did you see in college, in your own experience, that influences the way you think about problems like sexual assault? Do you think the financial pressure on universities to attract students is playing a role in all of this? And what about parents? Are they too strict or not as permissive as they should be? And what do you want out of college? Do you want a social experience, an education, a little bit of both? If you're a parent, what are you hoping your kids will get out of college? Again, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, again, radiowest@kuer.org. Elizabeth Armstrong is a professor of sociology and organizational studies at the University of Michigan. She's co-author of a book called Paying for the Party: How College Maintains Inequality. She's also written academic studies about sexual assault on campus, and she's joining us today from Michigan Public Radio in Ann Arbor. And Professor Armstrong, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks a lot.
Well, I wanted to start with the premise in your writing, because you say the experience of a student in college is shaped, that's sort of the clincher word, it seems to me, shaped by the structure of both academic and social life on campus. Give us a sense of that, how it's shaped by what's going on.
Well, when a student arrives on campus, they arrive in a world that already exists. It's there before they get there. They move into residence halls, in some campuses that have had reputations for decades before they've gotten there. They move into sort of peer cultures that are there before they got there. And fraternities and sororities are old organizations. They've been around on campuses for a long time. They're moving into a world where they're learning the ropes. They have kind of expectations about what it will be like. And actually, some of them are really excited about the prospect of coming and partying and getting drunk and hooking up and all of that. But that's enabled by kind of worlds that are there that they find.
Yeah. It's interesting because you've said that even you, a woman with a PhD now has tenure, your father was a college professor. You say even you had a hard time kind of navigating all of this, figuring out exactly how it works.
Oh, yeah. Well, from both the parent perspective and right. also from the research perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I started this project because I was teaching at a big research university, and I was teaching this undergraduate class on sexual diversity. And my students were coming into class and, well, they were talking, for one thing, this was about 10 years ago or a little more, they were talking about hooking up. And I'm like, what's that? Is that the same thing that was happening when I was in college? I don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at times also, like, I remember observing in the back of some of my colleagues' classes, and I had this, like, really distinct feeling that they were kind of taking a break from the real work of college. They were reading the newspaper and doing puzzles. Now often they're like on their laptops shopping for shoes or on ESPN or Facebook, sometimes if they're in a big lecture hall. And I was like, I thought the work of college was happening in the classroom. But it really seemed like it was kind of a real breather from the work of college. And then my co-author Laura Hamilton and I, we moved into, or rather got a room in a residence hall, a party dorm in this big university. And there we saw where the real work of college was happening.
Yeah.
These young women were very anxious about their social lives and getting into sororities and status on campus, and that was where the energy was.
I want to break down that study because you learned a lot. You point out early in your book what we know a lot about the impact of a college degree. We know that it, you know, the advantage that comes with it economically speaking. We know, you know, which majors have the best returns. We know the advantage that affluent students have in getting a higher education. But what you say we don't know very well is what's going on inside the university, what you call the black box of higher education. Tell us what you mean by that, the internal culture, I guess.
Yeah. Well, in terms of academics have spent a lot of time figuring out what predicts who goes to college and then also measuring the kind of returns on investment. And there we hear, and it's true, that those who have a college degree earn more than those who don't. But what we don't know as much is kind of the sort of sorting processes that occur both academically and socially while students are in the university. So by having the spot right on the residence hall floor, right as these young women were kind of moving into the university, we kind of saw the sorting process in action. We saw who made friends and who didn't. How making friends helped people stay on campus and who left, how people moved into higher quality majors and how social involvement ended up leading some students to kind of lower their ambitions in terms of their majors, kind of changing from kind of harder majors to easier majors to kind of in order to go out and party more. So we saw how all of that worked. And then, you know, we ended up seeing that actually we followed them for the entire 5 years that they were in college, and the first year they were out, at least some of them,
right.
and were done. And we found that both their class background, where they came from, and also what happened to them in college, which was very influenced by their class background, influenced how well they were doing that year out, that it was not in any way a kind of generic, like, everybody does great. It was like, no, some people had really good jobs and no debt. Other people had no jobs or bad jobs and a lot of debt. And so we traced out kind of how their decisions and what happened to them and what was available to them at the university influenced these things.
You know, we'll talk about this in particular as we go along. How much of the but just generally, how much it does the sort of partying pathway influence compared to affluence and class? I mean, what sort of influence is that? You know what I mean?
Well, they work together. From the university point of view, like what we mean when we talk about the party pathway is that there's a set of sort of organizational arrangements that the university maybe doesn't like but ends up kind of sponsoring anyway, that it's composed of like the Greek system, residential life arrangements that allow kind of affluent, socially oriented students to live together. And we refer to also easy majors, majors that don't require much work, that enable a lot of partying, things like having no Friday classes, which is often the case at some of these schools. And these things kind of enable this kind of peer culture to take place. And so what we find is for the very most wealthy students, students who are coming from so much money that they actually really may not actually really need to work to make a living, it's a very small, very tiny fraction of students on college campuses, but they kind of set the social tone for everybody else. So they're partying wildly, partying at the school that we observe sometimes 3, 4, 5 nights a week. We had young women reporting, you know, taking 20 or more shots, or one of them reported that she passed out in a porta potty at one point and noted that she thought that one might have been a little unsafe. So the other students are, some of them are trying to keep up. It's kind of, we refer to this group called wannabes.
Right.
These students who aren't as wealthy, they really need the human capital that they should be potentially acquiring in college, but they get kind of lured onto this party pathway. And it's in a lot of campuses, this is really visible. The fraternities are big. They're right near campus. There's the football games and the tailgates and the drinking and all of that. It's very seductive. And people get this notion that that's what college should be like, mm-hmm. that this is the college experience, that if you don't just dive into that, you know, in a really big way, you're somehow missing out. And for some students, they can experience that without having it affect them very negatively at all. But for other students, it had, you know, really, really catastrophic effects.
Yeah. I want to ask you this, and I don't mean this facetiously in any way. How much of the book and the way you talk about this is sort of perceived casually as kind of a, like you're a buzzkill? Do you know what I mean? Like, come on, lady, this is supposed to be fun. And I mean, there is the really scary specter of sexual assault for sure. But take that out for just a moment. And how much of this is being perceived as, you know, these kind of, puritanical kind of ideas?
Yeah, well, I think that's I mean, teaching college students, and I mean, I'm still very much like in the classroom and kind of and relating to students. I think that is something that's really important when it comes to issues of kind of educating students about drinking and about sexual violence and the like, because their first inclination is like, wait, you're trying to ruin the party.
Yeah.
And education that doesn't figure out how to kind of work with students to figure out how college can still be fun and they can still have a good time isn't going to work. People do want to have a good time in college, and that's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and some of it is I sometimes get in trouble. Like I got in trouble once at, you know, I was asked to do a presentation and I was kind of still too much in the field, and it was at a student orientation event and the parents were there. And so I kind of forgot that the parents were there and I was talking to the students and I was trying to impress on them the difference between 6 drinks and 26 drinks. And like I think, well, you know, and that really matters because you're not going to die from 6 drinks usually. And I was basically more or less kicked off the stage and disinvited and fired from participation in future orientation events because, you know, I was supposed to be kind of being very reassuring to parents that your students aren't going to drink at all. This is going to be an entirely academic experience. I'm a professor. They're going to be in my office, you know, talking about like ideas. And whereas I was trying to sort of communicate to students like how to kind of basically not just give, you know, not have fun at all, but how to lessen the risk, how to be somewhat safer.
Yeah, but you were dealing with the reality, and the parents didn't want to hear that, right? I mean,
often the parents can't hear it.
Yeah.
I've having a 18-year-old son, and you know, kind of having done this research and still being in the classroom, I find myself in many conversations with my friends kind of going, you know, this is kind of actually what's going on, yeah. And they, you know, they really don't want to know. And I think it's really important that parents do know what's happening in a very realistic way, in a way that's not that doesn't then, and, you know, one response when parents have any sort of a clue is then they try to shut things down. At least when kids are in high school and they still have some kind of control, they try to shut things down in a really kind of like you will not go out at
right.
all
right.
kind of
right.
way, which off doesn't really work either.
Well, see, I think that's part of the argument. I actually want to come back to this question of whether or not parents are too permissive, or there could be an argument, I think, made, you know, that they're not permissive enough on some levels. But we'll mm-hmm. come back to that.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you, the principal argument, it seems, in your book that you co-authored with Laura Hamilton is about how a higher education really affects what you call this, you know, class reproduction or mobility, you know, inequality mm-hmm. in the system.
Yeah.
But obviously, the part of the conversation today is about sexual assault. So can we look at the structures that you write about in your book and find, you know, an explanation to the prevalence of sexual assault on campus? I mean, it all plays into this, does it not?
Yeah, it does. And I think what we kind of see sexual assault as a kind of predictable outcome of a combination of factors, that the students are kind of arriving kind of primed to party. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of ready and looking for the party, and often they're frequently clustered together in large, like often freshman-only dorms with relatively little adult supervision. And a number of them are coming from – many of them are coming from situations where they had high levels of adult supervision and then moving to very low levels. In some campuses, like the one that we observed, a fraternity system where – the pretty much only way to get access to alcohol underage is by going to these parties, giving these men basically kind of a tool that enables them to control and organize and script how social life proceeds,
right.
So they can let in who they want to let
it's
in.
It's power.
And
it's
turn
it's
away.
Social
yeah,
power.
Yeah, it's power.
Yeah.
So alcohol it's a resource. It's both a resource and a weapon in some ways. I mean, it basically lures people there. It moves them around. You can say, like, these people can come into the back room. These people can't. These people get the good booze. These people get the bad booze. You can kind of arrange things. And then there are ways that, as we know, that young men use alcohol to basically get young women much more intoxicated than the women are aware of, like all the kind of punches that mm-hmm. are made that are the kind of grain alcohol punches. And, you know, there's notions that people don't perceive alcohol as a weapon because generally someone has to sort of make a personal decision to ingest it. But if they don't know what they're ingesting or how much they're ingesting, or back to the parents, if they're really, really, really inexperienced, if they've been very protected in high school and they come into these situations. I mean, it is the case that the most vulnerable week for sexual assault of the entire college experience is that very first week, those first weeks of the first year. Because students are just, you know, older students, the older men know that these women are particularly naive, and the women they don't necessarily have a safety net yet set up of people who they trust and that they can protect them. They're eager to dive in and participate.
They're all in one place. I mean, these freshmen who have all of this anxiety, who have mm-hmm. the ones who have the, you know, whose prefrontal cortex isn't quite there exactly yet. They're all in one place, and you've said that's part of the problem.
Oh yeah, the floor that we studied on was so full of homecoming queens and prom, you know, squad members and cheerleaders, and just these young women were so beautiful. It was even the most beautiful of them were intimidated by each other. They were so anxious and so insecure. Some of them had been used to dominating the sort of social scenes of their high school, and then they're like all like, you know, put together, and they were competitive with each other, and they were definitely saw the social scene as one of the main venues in which they needed to kind of go out and see people, see and be seen, prove themselves, show that they could fit in, show off their outfits. and the like. So there was – and so kind of concentrating all of that together. Like there was another dorm on campus that – where freshmen and through sophomores, juniors, and seniors lived together, and it was like more low-key, and it was a living learning center with like more academics kind of going on, and just – it was much less like, you know – fraught to be there. There was just a lot less anxiety. The upperclassmen kind of cut that a little bit.
It's important to say, of course, that not everyone partied at the school, even though you chose to sort of situate yourself in the party dorm.
Mm-hmm.
But you said even those who didn't want to party, they were still shaped by the dominant culture of the floor.
Yeah. Well, those on the floor who happen to be in this kind of really party-oriented dorm, their whole college experience was shaped by being there, partly because they ended up having no friends, which meant that it was hard for them to find places to live the next year. So some of them ended up going back into the dorm another year to basically kind of reboot their social experience and start over. The savvier ones are like, well, maybe I should move to a different dorm where – yeah. Where the experience might be different. Some of them left the university. So it was quite consequential. But even for students who weren't in this particular dorm, we did a series of focus group interviews with all sorts of different sort of sets of students, with LGBT identified students and sort of academic students and sort of students from the alternative dorm. And all of them kind of defined their identities in relationship to or opposition to these Greek kind of mainstream students. So,
wow.
And in the classes, I mean, teaching there, I really realized I had to kind of target and win over these really mainstream socially oriented Greek students in order for the whole class to work.
So wait, does that mean then that, what we would have sort of thought of as the very basic, simple social dynamics of high school, the popular kids, the burnouts, the, mm-hmm. The goth kids, all of that, that even in college, the popular kids are having a really profound influence over the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, in some schools.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's different at the university level is that people can select different schools. Like, the students who go to Swarthmore Reed or Sarah Lawrence are not the same ones that go to Ohio State. And so you get these people sort of moving. I mean, the savvier, the more educated parents are and the savvier and the more wealthy people are, the kind of more they're making very sophisticated decisions about where to go to college and where to send their college based on sort of fit and cultural fit and where their child's likely to do well. So that does mean that I mean, these really big schools tend to be very internally diverse, and there's lots of sort of subcultures and different worlds on a campus, these really big public universities. But yet there's often a kind of, a dominant kind of thread to it, a kind of a tone, yes, a sense that you feel kind of walking around campus that, wow, this is kind of a party school. Right. I can tell just, walking through the main kind of quad.
Elizabeth Armstrong is with us. She co-authored, along with Laura T. Hamilton, Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. We invite you to join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the culture of college life. The sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong is with us. She says you have to understand the structure of college life that puts women and men at risk for sexual assault. She's joining us to explain how students have come to expect a social experience out of college more than an academic one. Her book that she co-authored with Laura Hamilton is called Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. And we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's a letter from Hannah who writes, I went to a large Midwestern university, spent my junior year going to university in Europe. She says the scene there was very different. Yes, there were parties like bars and dorms that were open one evening a week for everyone to gather. She says a good friend of mine joined a sorority the year I was away. And though she still had great relationships, or still has great relationships with her sister, she was also sexually assaulted her junior year. Hannah writes, "It colored my opinion, of course, when our own daughter started university. I tried to be open to whatever path she wanted to take, but I laid out benefits and risks in a very different way than I thought of it in the past." I guess, and you can testify to this, I suppose, Elizabeth Armstrong, having a kid now in college, mm-hmm. that absolutely changes your perspective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I told him that, well, he wasn't not going to participate in a fraternity in college, that was just off the table.
Yep.
But it's hard. It's hard. I mean, I, this is kind of, you know, more personal, but I just learned this today. I mean, the school, I found out from a text message from him this morning that he had been at a fraternity party, this past weekend where a young student had fallen out of the window, the third floor window of the fraternity, and whose health condition is unknown at this point. Yeah. So my own kid was, yeah. you know, is a freshman and is in this situation where, as much as I've tried to kind of steer him in ways to sort of reduce the risk, is still in a situation where, you know, where it's quite risky. And, you know, that is frustrating, and you know, because it's difficult to, as a parent, to kind of, you can't micromanage everything from long distance. So what you do hope is that these universities that they are doing everything that they can to figure out how to understand the sources of risk, and to figure out how to work with the students and work with parents and work with legal police and legal authorities to reduce the risks.
But I wanted to get to this question mm-hmm. about the pressure of universities, the pressure of money. I mean, you say that almost all universities, except those very rare ones who have these massive endowments, you know, they have to worry about tuition money. And so the university has come to see a student, you say, kind of as a customer, a customer who has, you know, climbing walls and all sorts of these resources for them to have a really good time. That it's not so much about the academics, although that's clearly there, mm-hmm. but it's also about the social experience. That's as important in some ways.
Yeah, so the university is caught in a difficult situation because on the one hand, faculty, administrators, university presidents, all of them want their students to be healthy and to not get injured. Nobody wants these bad things to happen, sexual assault, drinking-related incidents. Nobody wants these to happen. But on the other hand, they also need tuition. And if what students are asking for is a kind of socially oriented experience. If you know that, like, think, just imagine what would happen if Wisconsin or University of Iowa or Florida State decided that it was going to like eliminate its Greek system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to even fathom how that could even occur. I mean, and would students still go? And so, and it happens even in kind of smaller ways. Like in the residence hall we studied, the party dorm was further away from classes. It didn't have there were no private bathrooms where there were in some other residence halls on campus. It was had more surveillance. There was more of a lockdown feel to it. It was less clean because of the partying of the students.
Mm-hmm.
And it had less kind of programming, less academic support in the residence hall. Yet parents called up if their daughters did not get put in this dorm to complain to residence life, like, put her there or we're going to send her to a different school.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a set of families who are kind of actually making decisions about sending students out of state to school to, like, which is the most fun, kind of most vibrant kind of party school. And And those are very affluent people. And it's so it's hard to basically even say things like, well, no, we're not actually going to move your daughter to a different dorm or, you know, and or actually we don't think it's best for students to have these kind of luxury kind of apartment style living. It's not pedagogically best for them, and it's going to drive up the kind of cost of tuition for all students, even those who can't, you know, who have no interest in such luxury accommodations. We're just not going to do it.
Say something a little bit more about that, the idea of these dorms. You know, they used to be, you know, what, like 6 bunk beds crammed into a place or something like that. And now, like you said, they're these kind of – there are these apartments where there's single beds, so they don't have to really interact with each other. They're a little isolated. This is another one of those structural elements that you write about.
Yeah, and it's that's isolating, and well, it enables. There's lots of different ways that students are can be protected from having to kind of interact with others that are not very much like themselves in college. I mean, we have this kind of, in some ways, at least. At least some people, I think, have a kind of a notion that college is this time to like really kind of get out of one's comfort zone, to become a kind of more of a cosmopolitan citizen by learning to kind of interact with others that are quite different from oneself. But students can do by joining the Greek system or by, you know, knowing the kind of reputations of various residence halls if they're allowed to select into them, or if they can select a roommate beforehand. They can even now, and at times because of Facebook, you can even preject a roommate sometimes by if you can go and like Facebook them and figure out that they're not someone who you think you would feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And or you can go into these apartment style living situations where you can basically kind of shield yourself and block yourself off from kind of interaction with people that you wouldn't you don't imagine that you would like.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Steve is with us in Wendover. Steve, welcome.
Hey, good morning. Actually, I'm pulled over. I'm from Southwest Colorado. Hey, I have a question. My wonder is, when I went to college in the late 70s and early 80s, and I don't remember ever seeing this sort of a predatory nature amongst the people I was with. I was in a fraternity. We were drinking at 18 back then. We had huge campus-wide sponsored parties, hundreds of kegs, and it was a good school. It was a hard school to get into. So what I don't remember is just sort of a predatory nature per se, and I just wondered if there's any data that would say that there's predators are more prevalent now, or is it kind of an attitude shift in society where what used to be just kind of a part of the status quo is now sort of seen more as an assault. And then just secondly, I would say that, that there's another group of a subset of folks here that men and women just drink too much and then mistakes are made. I don't see it as a I have a friend who had some real difficulties in life secondary to a date rape thing in Ogden, actually. He was just as drunk as the woman he was with. So,
well, okay. So let's deal with that first mm-hmm. one. Which is, I think, is a very good question. What do you make of that question that, somehow it was different in the past? There weren't as many predators. That's what do you think about that?
I don't think we really know. Yeah. I think that the statistics on sort of sexual violence are so hard to know what to make of those numbers. I think that the notion that things are kind of more predatory now is a little hard to kind of fathom, because in terms of what I'm aware of, in terms of the kind of the national crime statistics, things are actually, I think, in some ways safer. So I think, it's hard to know. I guess where I kind of come down on it is that the issue is, at least since the 80s, we've been aware that there's a problem of sexual assault on campus, and universities have been attempting to try to get a handle on it and try to do something. And what's remarkable is how unsuccessful the efforts have been. So the problem's fairly longstanding, and the kind of efforts to kind of get a handle on it have just basically not worked.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know in terms of the before and after. On the other point, I do think in terms of the issue of men and women, I think that there's a tendency to kind of in some kind of quarters to basically see women as the only ones at risk in these worlds. And I think that's just absolutely not true. I think that young men, there's the risks of alcoholism. There's the risks of dropping out of school. There's the risks of – they're often the ones that fall out of the fraternity windows and die from the keg stands and, you know, try to jump from one porch to the next and, you know, fall. So the men are at risk too. And the men are at risk of sexual violence. The men – there's a pretty high amount of kind of male sexual violence that isn't talked about much. And with everybody being so blindingly drunk, there's the heterosexual sexual assault that occurs that occurs to men.
Yeah.
Some of the young men that I know who've done interviews specifically with young men about sex have like referred to things like a young man waking up and realizing someone was giving him fellatio and that was not his idea of something to occur and he was not, you know, that's sexual assault as
yeah.
well. So there's the crassness of the sexual culture is something that, you know, is affects men and women both.
Steve, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Jen is with us in Salt Lake City. Jen, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting conversation. I also am old enough to have gone to college in the 80s when the drinking age was actually, well, the state I went to school in was 19. And over the years I was in college, it actually raised every year to 21. So I'm interested in your opinion on the effects of the drinking age, perhaps, on this culture. I mean, alcohol obviously has a strong role in social dynamics in this country, both in college and beyond. When I was in high school, I also went to France, and it was a very different culture. The kids were drinking wine with their parents. They would, this is in high school, be willing to switch to Orangino or something, whereas in the United States, it was a very much a party and binge culture. But I'm wondering if you have data on the effects of raising the drinking age on specifically on binge drinking and on harm, and if you have any recommendations and how we might actually teach kids how to drink moderately, or if that's just beyond the pale in college.
Let's talk about both of those things, Jen. Thanks very much. But start with the alcohol laws question. But then I wanted to get to that European question because that's something you've talked about.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the issues about the 21-year-old drinking age is that that means that law means that university administrators have basically nothing to work with in terms of trying to figure out how to create a kind of more moderate drinking culture on campus, because they have no choice but to impose a basically zero tolerance yeah. policy.
Which pushes it off of campus.
Which pushes it off. So, for example, in the school that we observed, they had kind of police were – the party dorm was kind of not – there was not that much – well, almost no active drinking in public locations in the residence hall itself, because it was tightly locked down. It was surveilled. I mean, they had people walking around kind of police and staff all the time, and they ticketed people right and left if they saw it, which of course pushed it off to the fraternities. And so you know, in terms of if alcohol is something that you can use to sort of kind of entice people to sort of stay on campus or participate or kind of come and figure out some kind of more moderate way to do it, schools just now can't do that at all. I'm not necessarily to kind of move to the kind of European point. I'm not necessarily sure, though, that if we just suddenly lowered the drinking age, whether that would have that much of a positive effect here. We wouldn't suddenly become Europe in
right.
the sense of the whole norms about drinking, what alcohol means. I mean, somehow in the U.S., alcohol has really become associated with a kind of youth culture sort of opposition to adulthood, like we're cool, we're hip, we're not like those stodgy adults. And to sort of change the meaning of alcohol and to kind of inculcate a more kind of moderate drinking culture, I think would take a lot more than simply like lowering the drinking age.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, that question of just how permissive should a parent be comes up. some sense that in a more open culture, like in certain European countries, that they're, you know, they're somehow more realistic about sex, more realistic about alcohol consumption, that it's less a taboo and less an exciting kind of thing. So there's not the same level of binge drinking and binge having sex, I guess, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So what? But that's their culture. This is ours. It's going to be pretty difficult to shift that cultural sensibility, I would guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's really right, and it relates to sex as well. Like a colleague of mine who's at University of Massachusetts has a book, Not Under My Roof, where she compares Dutch and American parents' attitudes toward teen sex and finds that the Dutch parents are like fine with their kids having their boyfriend or girlfriend sleep over and fine with them having sex as long as they're really in love and the relationship is really serious and they take the kind of loving relationships of their teenagers very seriously and incorporate the kind of partner into the family, which is so different than the American notion of kind of this, as she puts it, raging hormones and kind of like, oh, you know, this, I don't want to see it. Not my son, not my daughter, not happening. So it is related to this, you know, the kind of whole constellation of sort of different kind of cultural sensibilities between Europe and here. Yeah.
Let me ask you one more sort of question related to this before we head to a break. This comes from Benjamin, who writes, he's read a lot about the culture of hyper-parenting in America, where parents police and monitor and nurture their children's every waking moment. Benjamin writes, could it be that when you release these coddled, hyper-surveilled and hyper-parented youths into a college culture where they're finally given some freedom, maybe they're reveling in the chance to cut loose, maybe, you know, too loose? He writes, if we gave today's kids more freedom sooner, would we see fewer problems later?
Yeah, I think there's really something to that. Like a school where I was teaching before, one of my friends was on the kind of judicial board, and she often reported that the very most problematic cases were cases where kids had gone from like incredible, you know, surveillance to just absolutely kind of unable to kind of regulate themselves. And that we saw on our residence hall floor as well. And this was also related to social class, because parents who were highly educated themselves and who understood that their daughters were going into contexts that were quite difficult to navigate, they had savvy that they conveyed to their daughters. In fact, the mother-daughter conversation was more protective than we expected to find in terms of helping, you know, young women kind of navigate college life safely. I mean, at least before they got on campus, these young women listened to their moms, and their moms said, well, you know, always keep a buddy around, or, you know, don't take a drink from someone and stuff like that. And they actually followed their advice. I mean, I know people see these precautionary strategies as potentially victim blaming, because it still puts the onus on the kind of woman for protecting herself and not on the men from not, like, you know, committing the assault. But, you know, yet the women who had like a little bit of partying experience in high school, who'd had some amount of freedom, who had a pretty open relationship with their parents and talked about it, a little more freedom, some education and precautionary strategies from their parents, they were able to navigate it a little more safely.
Elizabeth Armstrong is with us. She co-wrote, along with Laura Hamilton, Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. Thanks very much for the calls. We invite you to join us at 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the sociologist Elizabeth Armstrong. She's co-author of the book Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. We're talking about how college culture, university culture works, and how it plays into this issue, this problem of sexual assault on campuses across the country. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Rick is joining us in Orem, Utah. Rick, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a second cousin who was a recently returned missionary, LDS missionary, who went from a small town, Idaho town, to Boise State, and was trying to fit into the social scene and pledging at a fraternity, and died from alcohol poisoning his first week on campus.
Oh, dear.
Wow. You know, I guess beyond
hazards, it's not just sexual assault.
Yeah, no, well, it's absolutely not just sexual assault. It's,
no, of course. And it does. It actually raises an interesting question, given that we're, you know, here in Salt Lake City. And I wonder if you're seeing – what are the differences? I mean, clearly there's Brigham Young University. There's a large population of LDS people in Utah and in the – as was mentioned there by Rick, in the Intermountain West and in Idaho there. But I'm wondering if you're seeing in the Bible Belt in places like Utah, does this story play out in any different way, if you've even looked at that? The role of religion, I guess.
Religion can be incredibly protective. On the campus that we studied, there were some highly religious students who were kind of evangelical, kind of Christians. They were Campus Crusade for Christ navigators, and what those organizations did was create an entire like enclosed, separated off student culture with entirely different values and activities, social events, Bible studies, just a different world. And, you know, those students were really quite protected from the whole kind of alcohol, you know, party culture world. And interestingly, what I've found in terms of the kind of group interview that I did with a number of the women in there is that having it created more space to do work. I mean, they were quite happy, and they were I mean, in some ways they looked better than some mm-hmm. of the other women, in the sense that they were like having this extremely clean lifestyle, and they kind of the excuse not to have to be participating in the kind of the hookup stuff worked for them. And you know, the other things didn't maybe work as well, but religion can provide one form of kind of protection from this world. I mean, of course, it doesn't work for everyone, and not everyone would want that, but that we did see that at the school we studied.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Here's a note from Holly Mullen, actually, who writes, she wants to make it clear a person, of course, cannot give consent for sex while intoxicated. Mm-hmm. And she writes this, the victim-blaming culture that says heavy drinking somehow puts a person at risk for rape and that she somehow deserves it for making a poor choice needs to end. What does that point come into all of this, this idea? I mean, that you're hearing people saying, you know, people are making poor choices, that, you know, there's these structural elements that come into play, and that somehow – you know, what effect does that have on that question that Holly mentions? That none of this excuses, of course, the idea that they're sexually assaulted, men or women.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that the victim blaming that occurs, particularly among students, is really pervasive. And I see in the victim blaming among students as basically a way to to try to preserve their party culture, because what they can say is, well, she got too drunk, or she didn't know how to handle herself, or, she was a slut anyway, so, you know, whatever. I mean, so there's a way in which, like, even the women, and we've written a paper on that, on the sort of slut shaming, on college campuses, that even the women sort of participate in kind of basically both engaging in victim blaming and kind of slut shaming of women. And part of it is to sort of to increase their own status and also create a sense of kind of invulnerability. This isn't going to happen to me because I know how to handle myself, or I'm not like that. And I think though that we cannot use that as an excuse not to talk about the role of alcohol in this, because empirically, you know, many of these campus assaults do involve either the victim or the assailant or both, or situations where you can't tell which is which. Right. And that we've got to deal with how these things are connected. And simply saying, well, let's not talk about the alcohol because that's victim blaming isn't going to do it. But we also can't just falling into kind of the victim blaming, like, or like even as I was discussing before, the kind of precautionary strategies, like seeing it as women's responsibility to kind of engage in all these precautionary strategies, that falls quickly mm-hmm. into victim blaming. So trying to figure out how the whole social world is organized such that these incidents predictably occur and that are harmful to both men and women, and is the goal, I think.
Let me come back around to something we were talking about earlier. You know, that conundrum you write about universities who are trying to help their students have this, as you put it, primarily social experience, but not failing academically, which leads them to something we briefly talked about, which is some of these easy majors that students get driven to and those kinds of things. But I guess it really raises this question of what is it that students want from the experience? Is it social? Is it academic? Do we have to start shifting away from the fact that, look, have fun somewhere else? College should be about training and academia, or is that just not realistic at this point?
Well, I mean, the students are, of course, an incredibly diverse group. But even just looking at those that are attending four-year residential schools, they want lots of different things.
Right.
I think one of the things that we found in our study is that the students who were actually floating, they had very little notion of why they were doing this. They were kind of there by default. It's what their parents and kind of their high school said was the logical next step. They kind of wanted everything a little bit. They thought they could be kind of really academic and really social, and they didn't have very clear ideas about career goals, or those are the students who did the least well. And so kind of clarifying, I mean, that's one thing that I think families can do. Parents can really sit down with their kids and be like, okay, this is going to be an expensive investment all the way around.
Let's figure it out.
Let's figure it out. Yep. Why are we doing this? We've so naturalized this notion that this is the inevitable next step.
Elizabeth Armstrong, co-author of the book Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. Thank you very much for spending the time.
Thanks for having me here. I enjoyed it.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.